Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 353 of the Professional Book Nerds podcast presented by Overdrive. This is Adam, joined by Jill. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. Sorry, I should have given your proper title. Twice published author, Jill Grunewald.
Okay.
Hello, Jill.
Hi.
You should have like an air of like, yes, I'm a memoirist now. Not just written a memoir. Now you're a memoirist who's done multiple.
That's not what that means.
I know. I'm going to keep doing it. I'm going to keep doing it.
I've been a memoirist with the first one.
I know, but is a, yes, you're right. I don't know. Everyone, you will have not appreciated much as I did, but as Jill has said in the past, you're very bad at self-promotion.
I'm terrible at self-promotion.
And so we use Slack at our office. And so in our team Slack, Jill told our team, like, hey, everybody, I wrote a book. It's out today. You should go check it out. And like, I responded. I was like, thank God, because if you hadn't done it, I was going to promote you for you just to make sure the world should know, especially your coworkers
that you're an author.
Our CEO didn't realize you had written a book until like a year after the first one had come out.
Okay, that's true.
Yeah. I'm just saying. So go check out Joe's
book. I've at least told him about this one. I don't know if he actually remembers, but I've told him.
He probably does, because he famously tells us all that he never reads fiction, so he probably will actually read your books.
That's true.
I really want Steve to read your books. That would be so funny to me.
I am bringing a copy for him.
Like, you should. Steve. Sign it.
It's library stuff.
Yeah. He loves library stuff.
He does.
He gives away the Susan Orlean book to every librarian he meets.
I know. We were at ALA, and I opened the cabinet.
There's so many. He does this whole, like, adorable speech where he's like, every librarian should have their own copy of this book, which is very charming, and it's true. But if you were to open our booth, you just see stacks and stacks.
There's stacks and stacks.
I feel like Steve's half the reason that Susan stayed on the New York Times bestsellers list as long as she has, because Steve bought, like, trillion copies. Anyway, none of that is today's episode.
No, it is not.
Do you want to tell people what today's episode is all about?
Sure. So today's episode is an interview I did with Lisa Tadeo about her book, Three Women, which is getting tons of buzz.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked about it. I talked about it in the July book pick episode. And I talked about it when I was reading it a couple months ago. It is fascinating, utterly, utterly fascinating book in which, for a decade, Lisa Tadeo moved her family around and sort of became very close friends with these three different women in different parts of the United States and got to know their lives, specifically their sex lives. And so one of them is a married woman who's having an affair. One of them is a married woman whose husband likes knowing she is sleeping with other people. And then the third one is a teenage girl who allegedly had an inappropriate relationship with her high school teacher who went on to be like teacher of the year. And then she comes forward to talk about this and it is the town kind of turns on her. So, the book is, I will warn you, the book is graphic, but it needs to be. And she does not hold back. And so when I got an advanced copy, I think I finished it in a weekend and immediately came in then on Monday and emailed the publisher. And I was like, I need to talk to her because I have so many questions about the book and the process and the women in it, especially the high school student. I mean, she's an adult now, but I mean, you know, she uses fake names and pseudonyms for the others. But you can look up all that information about Maggie and and everything that happened, and, you know, just like the bravery that comes with coming forward with that again after it. So it was a really great conversation, finding out about how it worked and how she found the women. And I highly, highly recommend the book. Like I said, it's getting a lot of press and a lot of buzz for very good reason. So yeah, I was glad to have the opportunity to talk to Lisa about it.
And I'm sure you guys will all have thoughts on it. And if you do, you can find us on social media at Pro Book Nerds on both Twitter and Instagram. And you can find our website, professionalbooknerds.com. I'm guessing we may have some new listeners, because were you on Reading Glasses this past week? Do you know? I know you did an interview with our friends.
At the time of this recording, I'm not sure if it's gone out yet.
Okay. Well, if you are listening to us because you heard Joe on Reading Glasses, hello. Go to our website, professionalbooknerds.com, where you can see all of our 352 previous episodes. Don't try to listen to them all at once. That'd be crazy.
And just skip the first few, because...
For the love of God, don't listen to the first few. We, as proud as I am of our first few interviews, we did not know anything about sound. It always reminds me of the movie Zach and Miriam Make a Porno, where I have a point. They'll get to it.
I know.
At the beginning, there is a part where one of the guys has really long hair, and he's like supposed to be the hottie from the high school. And he's like, yeah, that's like before I knew anything about proper hairstyling or hair care. That's how I feel when I talk about our first few episodes. I'm like, it's before we knew anything about proper sound or sound quality. Yeah, don't listen to this. Okay. Is there anything else you think people should know about?
No, I think that's it.
Awesome. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed this interview with Lisa Tadeo on the Professional Book Nerds podcast.
Hi everyone, this is Jill, and with me today is Lisa Tadeo, a journalist and writer. Her work has appeared in the Best American Political Writing and the Best American Sports Writing anthologies, along with publications like Esquire, Elle, Glamour, and New York Magazine. She's also winner of the Pushcart Prize. This July, she has a book out called Three Women, which I have to say is unlike anything I've ever read in my entire life, and I read a lot, so that's saying something. Lisa, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
So can you start by giving our listeners a brief introduction to Three Women?
Sure. It is a true story of the lives of three real women across the country who I followed for over the course of about 8 years and interviewed them, but also just sort of hung out with them while they were experiencing just various points in their emotional and love lives. And it begins with the first woman is named Lena. She's in suburban Indiana, and she finds herself stuck 10 years into a passionless marriage with a husband who no longer wants to kiss her on the mouth, and a couple therapist who tells her that that's okay, that the sensation offends him and that Lena has to accept it. The second woman is named Maggie. And she is a young woman in Fargo, North Dakota, who, as a high school student, allegedly had an affair with her high school English teacher. And the book picks up with her in the aftermath of the trial that shakes their quiet community. And the third woman is Sloane, who is a glamorous entrepreneur in the Northeast who owns a restaurant with her husband. And her husband likes to watch her have sex with other men and women, either in front of him or she can tape it and send it to him. And when I met her, she was trying to figure out where his desire ended and hers began.
As I said, when I read this book, I was just utterly blown away because the story of it and the writing. And I immediately wanted to interview because I had so many questions for you, starting with what made you want to write this book?
So, for the most part, it's twofold. The first was that my editor, Simon & Schuster, had read a story I wrote for New York Magazine and had taken me out to lunch and asked me, told me he would like me to write about something for book length and what sort of subjects interested me, which was both a really freeing and wonderful thing to say to someone and also completely crippling, because to have that much sort of license to just think for oneself, especially when I was, you know, about a decade younger in my early 20s. And it was crippling, but also really cool. So that was the first part. The reason I went towards this subject was because the editor, Joe B. Ferrari Adler, sent me a bunch of books that he thought I would like, nonfiction books by people like Janet Malcolm and Tracy Kidder and George Packer. And among the book, and Joan Didion, and among the books was Gay Talese Is Thy Neighbor's Wife. And I, in case you are not familiar, it's about, it was sort of taking the pulse of sexuality in America in the 70s and 80s. And there was a lot of swinging. And, you know, Mr. Talese was a big part of the research of the book. His person mm-hmm. was a big character of the book. And I was really, you know, I found it intriguing. And I also was thinking that nobody had since really done that sort of a deep dive into the world of desire and sexuality. And I was younger and dating in Manhattan, and I was very, you know, sort of my friends and I were constantly talking about dating and love and analyzing why someone had not called back or, you know, et cetera. So for all of those reasons, I just really was attracted to the idea of kind of cataloging where we were at with desire in America.
Sounds very Sex in the City. But as you know, talked about when you were describing the book, you spent sort of 8 years, I mean, almost a decade of your life kind of immersing yourself in the lives of these women. How did that all work? I mean, how did you find them? How did you move around? You know, that's just so interesting.
Thanks. Well, that was the hardest part of the process. It was, you know, when I first started out, I was in New York City. I was taking trips to places and to meet people that I thought might be interesting. One of the first places I went to was the Porn Castle, and I think it was referred to as the Porn Castle in the Mission District of San Francisco. I don't think it's there anymore. And, you know, I was watching people having sex with machines and people masturbating in front of laptops for someone on the other end who was paying by the 15-minute interval. And it was really fascinating, but I also realized that I didn't really want to write about that sort of the mechanics of sex at book length. And so I wanted to find the stories behind the acts. And that's what drove me to, I started out by driving across the country once, and I met a doctor in Indiana who was performing these hormone treatments on women who were like losing weight and feeling newly sexual in their new bodies. And I was really intrigued by that. And it was also in the same basic area as the Kinsey Institute. So my first move was to move to Indiana to get out of New York City and my, you know, limited worldview there and get into someone else's. And that was where I met Lena, the first woman, by forming a discussion group in her town in Indiana. And for the rest of the women, for the rest of the people, I wasn't really set on doing women only at that point. I was talking to hundreds of people, and I would just sort of go and meet them when, you know, sort of I had a lead from either a lawyer or a doctor, mm-hmm. an editor or a fellow writer, just whomever I thought would understand what I was looking for. And I drove across the country posting signs up, like on slot machines and casinos and on salon windows and post offices and just like everywhere that I thought I was going to maybe like the person that was going to, you know, be the person that with everything I wanted for this book would find it and miraculously write to me or call me.
Yeah. You mentioned in the introduction, I think it is, how you had followed for a while. You were talking to other couples or other women, and then they eventually sort of backed away from the project. Probably because they didn't, you know, were afraid their anonymity would be, that they would be identified. So yeah. What, you know, like what made Maggie, Lena, and Sloan want to commit to risking that?
You know, I don't I don't really know. What I can say is that certainly in the instances of Sloan and Lena, there was no quote unquote upside to talking to me. Which is why I think that, you know, the bravery, and certainly Maggie's bravery for, you know, for coming forward with something that, you know, a lot of people that she'd been sort of, you know, strung up in the press mm-hmm. and in the courthouse for doing, I think that their bravery and kind of just doing it was, I think it was for the larger good of other people. And so, like, one of the reasons I wanted to write about this is so that people would feel less alone in their desires and pain. And I think that that's one of the reasons why, you know, each of these women did it. And I'm really grateful to them, like, every day for doing that.
No, I agree. And I think it's interesting, you know, as you said, to help people not feel so alone, because you write about these women and their desires and their sex lives in a very graphic way, which is very unfamiliar to most readers. We don't really read about women, real women, in that way. But these are stories that women are living across the country. They just aren't having their stories told for whatever reason. So I'm glad you're sort of bringing to light these instances and relationships of being, you know, transparent and helping those readers feel like they're not alone.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that was definitely a pride motivation. And in terms of, you know, the sort of the way that I portrayed sex and the fact that I wanted it to be in there in a certain real manner was that, you know, I think that, but for Lena specifically, I think her section is the most explicit, I guess. And the reason for that is that I think Lena was finding herself mm-hmm. in these moments. And so I wanted to really accurately capture that. And also the way that women, you know, the way that these women and the way that I've certainly experienced it myself, the experience of sex, I think, for women is... Sorry, I have a cold. It's very different. You know, there's a lot of sort of, there's a lot of looking inside during it. And that was what I wanted to show, the way that that worked. The sort of, you know, you're not just, it's not just the physical presence. It's this other, these other thoughts that you're having in your brain. And I think that's one, you know, one difference, just biologically speaking, between the way that women and men experience the same act.
Right. And sort of on that, when we, you know, generally speaking, we're not used to seeing a woman's sexuality through the gaze of another woman, like a woman writer. So often it's sort of the male gaze that we're used to seeing through, and we experience these things through, which I think is also important why it's so... that a woman wrote this and you could handle that subject matter in a way that makes sense and kind of balances things out. And yet the male gaze just still sort of pops up in these stories, whether it's Maggie's teacher or Sloan's husband, and like the effect that has on the overall story is it just continues. Like there's really no way to escape it.
Totally. yeah. I mean, and that's the thing is that, you know, it's and I think it's, you know, it's the male gaze in these stories, but I think it's the gaze of whomever is sort of in control or in power in any given intimate relationship. And, you know, that's why I was sort of interested in writing about these people who were somewhat in the act of being gazed at, mm-hmm. Whether, you know, I just find it, I find it, you know, and the male gaze is something that, you know, I think it's, you know, whenever I watch TV and television and movies, I'm always looking for, hoping that there's a sort of, you know, a female gaze that is, like, you know, without being silly, because I think that a lot of, when people flip the male gaze and, like, have females looking at men in certain ways, it's kind of, it can be cartoonish and not really realistic. So, you know, I think it's important to show the female gaze in a way that's real and not just like, you know, turning the male gaze on its head and going, oh, this is women looking at men. But it's not really the way that, you know, heterosexual women look at heterosexual men, for example.
Right. One of the three, I think the one that interested me the most was Maggie's story. And I think because you definitely capture her in these two different phases of her life, you know, there's talking about the experiences allegedly with the teacher and then the impact that has had on her as an adult. And I admit that you talk about, again, I think in the introduction, how Maggie, the people, like, those are their real names unless they were underage. And so I admit I totally Googled her. And that, yeah. I mean, that's just so, I don't, that's so brave of her, I think, to come forward in that way and to be open and able to have this story continue to be told.
Yeah, I mean, it is, so, and that's, you know, that was one of the concerns with, you know, I mean, we all Google everything. And, you know, one of the things that Gay Talese told me when I met him was that, like, I had to use real names. And I think that that stunted my ability to find people for several mm-hmm. years of the project, because I was kind of intent on doing that. But I think the thing is, when he wrote his book, it was, you know, 1980. There was no, you know, Googling. There was no, and now it's just, it's so easy to not just, you know, to not just see someone on the, but sort of like go through all of their social media and understand all of these different things about him and about them in like minutes. And so that, you know, for Maggie to do that is, yeah, I mean, it's hugely brave. It is, you know, it's just, it'll, you know, it'll bring her story to a much larger audience, which I think on the one hand is really great, because I think, you know, she deserves to have her story heard, which I don't think was ever heard, not in the trial and certainly not, you know, in the local news reports mm-hmm. That accompanied it, because I think a lot of those were skewed in, you know, the teacher's direction, and there wasn't a lot of neutrality. And what, you know, what I thought was important about telling Maggie's story was telling her story and her, like, version of events that, you know, I think is vital. And, yeah, so the bravery in doing that in a world where you can Google someone's name and see all of these different aspects of them is, I will never, you know, I will never not be grateful for that and for what she's done for so many people who have already read it and have told me that, you know, her story has helped them deal with something that happened to them in the past, you know, et cetera.
Right. And because that's her real name, she's sort of risking all of that coming back again, sort of the negative backlash. Because anyone can kind of find her, which I think adds an extra layer of bravery there, that she's willing to put herself out there again.
Totally.
Which does actually, so how much, when it comes to Lena and Sloan, how much changes?
Changed.
Yeah, because I've been to where Sloan lives, like, in the book, and I was like, this is a really small town, actually. I feel like there's enough here that people can figure out, if they live there, like, they could figure out who she is. I'm curious how much was changed for their characters.
You know, some certain locations and, I mean, certainly the names were changed. I'm not really supposed to go into what was changed.
Oh, obviously.
Very little was changed. Yeah, no, I'm just saying, like, legally,
right.
Because then that, you know, opens yeah. them up further, too. But, yeah, I mean, very little, but, you know, the stories are completely, you know, everything that happens. There's no changing of that.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, there's definitely a danger of that, of, you know, their identities being uncovered. And it's something that, you know, keeps me up at night. And, you know, I don't know how much it would affect or harm each of the two women who aren't named. But I consider the worst possible scenarios, and it just makes me completely, you know, horrified. So I hope that doesn't happen. But at the same time, you know, I hope that if it does, that people are not you know, the people recognize the incredible amount of bravery and just the sort of, like, you know, honesty and coolness to give of yourself in a way that might make other people feel less alone. Is, I think, you know, is my hope.
Right. What was the writing process like for this? Were you kind of, because you spent, you know, again, almost a decade following these women, did you, were you always writing kind of along the way, or were you taking notes and then pieced everything together at the end? How did that work?
Yeah. So it, you know, it shifted a lot, but for the most part, it would be that while I was interviewing one woman, I would be, you know, either looking for the next subject or, you know, or if I wasn't, if I already had the next subject, I would be sort of taking notes, hanging out with that person during the morning or the afternoon or the evening, whatever time that they were able to give me or whatever time was something that would be interesting for me to see. And then the other times that I wasn't with them that day or that week, I would be writing from my notes about the woman or the person who had just come before that.
Okay. I'm curious if any of the women have read the book yet and what their reactions have been.
Two of them have, and their reactions have both been positive, and they felt that it was very, you know, sort of true to their stories and to the way that they felt, and they were really happy about the way that I captured them. And some of, for, you know, for one of them, it was very difficult to read about certain things.
Mm-hmm.
So both difficult and positive. And I guess in the end, that, you know, they felt that I had honored their stories, and, you know, that made me feel good. But it's definitely, you know, it's definitely not, I don't think it was easy for any of us.
Right. Right. Because I imagine even as a writer, it wouldn't have been easy, or, like, easy for you, because you have these women sharing with you these very intimate details about their life and trusting you with that. And that feels like a lot of pressure.
Yeah, it really is and was, and it continues to be. And, you know, I mean, it's hard to write about real people at any level, and it's almost impossible to write about real people in the realm of desire and love when, you know, everything is sort of like just stripped down mm-hmm. to our cores. So, you know, to that end, I think that, you know, I just think that, yeah, it's impossible. It's something that, you know, I didn't really know it was happening as it was happening. I think that if I had sort of like known the way that it was going to happen, I don't know that I would have, you know, continued. I'm not saying, like, I'm happy that the book is the book, and I'm happy it's here, and I feel like a lot of people are feeling really heard and seen by it so far, and that makes me feel really, like, you know, satisfied and, like, you know, like something positive is hopefully happening to for some people because of it. But, yeah, I mean, the sort of emotional cost for me and what I worry about being the emotional cost for the women is definitely something that, you know, just keeps me up at night.
So at the end of all of our interviews, we have something we call the Nerd 9, which are 9 lighthearted, rapid fire. Don't put too much thought into them, okay?
Okay.
What is the last book you finished reading?
Lucia Berlin, Evening in Paradise.
Favorite place to read?
Outside with food and a glass of wine.
What book made you fall in love with reading?
I think Stephen King, probably The Stand.
That's a good one. What place would you like to travel to that you haven't been to yet?
In Africa, the whole continent,
the whole thing.
But specifically, gosh, there's an actual place that it's in Zimbabwe, but I don't know the name of it. But it's whatever. It's Zimbabwe.
I put you on the spot. It's okay. Your favorite your favorite holiday?
Halloween.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee and tea.
Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Favorite food?
Sea urchin sushi.
And if you could have dinner with one person, dead or alive, who would it be?
My dad.
Finally, Lisa, what would you like readers to take away from reading Three Women?
That desire is universal, and that the best thing we can do for each other as human beings is not to judge. Is not to judge how something has hurt us and what hurts us and what makes us happy.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from overdrive.com, and our library friends can purchase these titles in Marketplace. Professional Book Nerds is proud to be an Evergreen Podcast signature program. To learn about other Evergreen podcasts, visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Our podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Adam Sokol and Jill Grunewald, and presented by Rakuten Overdrive. For more information, visit professionalbooknerds.com.
Hello, and welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo, and for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book, and together, we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our ninth season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.